You know, something in our nature as humans causes us to dehumanize others when we engage in conflict. I plead with all of my Republican colleagues, let cooler, more rational heads prevail.
And whose heads would those be, Congressman Warren Davidson of Ohio? Good luck.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't, but it's kind of funny.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
So I'll take it.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in rainy California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, and Round Mountains, KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, in Lanchester, Pennsylvania on W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day for your listening convenience on the internets, on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us once again in this now new-ish new year. Glad to have you with us for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. And as we go to air, yes, we are in the middle of day two of the GOP's uprising against the GOP in the U.S. House. That's right. It's a GOP on GOP uprising in the House.
It's so bizarre.
As they attempt to carry out what should be the easy first business of taking over the House majority, electing a speaker. But they can't do it so far on day two. It's also, by the way, day two of my ongoing ongoing on air with the cold. So apologies for that unavoidable annoyance. I guess the question now is, which will happen sooner? I'll be rid of this cold, or the Republicans will select a House Speaker, Desi Doyen?
It's a mystery.
But as the Republican rebels, without any actual apparent cause, continue their dumb uprising against I'm not sure what, I'm noticing, Des, that they seem to be entering the bargaining phase. Not actually, you know, bargaining with each other to, you know, try to come up with a House Speaker, a consensus candidate that they can all agree on, other than Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, but sort of bargaining with themselves, I mean, to try and justify what it is they are doing. I don't know if you noticed this today, but a number of those who spoke to, you know, repeatedly placed the name of a Republican challenger to Kevin McCarthy into nomination, they've noted that this is really what America wants
them to do.
DC,
I know.
To do. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
That they're sort of, you know, this is, they shouldn't be embarrassed by this. This is what America wants, an open, transparent debate on things that are going on in Washington. And while an argument could be made in favor of that, the problem is they're not actually debating anything here. They're just keep doing the same thing over and over again. They're putting names into nomination. They are voting. And then they are not coming up with enough votes to reach the required 218 votes that would be needed for a majority to name a new House Speaker so that they can actually begin the 118th U.S. Congress. They're not actually debating anything. There's no actual debate. They nominate people, they vote, it fails, they nominate again, they vote, it fails again.
And what's the old saying about doing the same thing over and over and over again and expecting a different result each time?
It makes you a Republican?
Close, but okay. I think it's actually insanity, which is definitely where we are right now.
Yeah, all of these members, and by the way, they are still just members-elect because they can't be actually sworn in until a House Speaker has been selected to swear them in. But they're not debating openly about any of this because it is unclear, at least to me, what the hell it is that these 20 or so GOP so-called rebels actually want, other than the fact that they don't want Kevin McCarthy to be the House Speaker, even though he has actually already promised to give them, I think, pretty much every single thing that they want. So instead, they're mentioning how great it is what they're doing. You know, instead of talking about the fact that they got what they want, or instead of putting forward what they're actually demanding, they're just talking about how great it is what they're doing, how much the American people really, really want this sort of debate, finally, from Congress.
And about how broken Washington is when it's really just, you know, these 20 right-wing reactionary Republicans kind of holding up the whole process.
And breaking everything. I mean, that's not a debate. It's a debate.
It's just breaking things.
Yeah. If there is a debate going on here, I have no idea what it is. I will see if my guest joining us momentarily has any better idea. He's actually here to discuss something that makes much more sense than, I think, what we're seeing playing out in the House, to talk about, you know, something regarding the media and the polls and how they both ended up skewing the 2022 results to give us what we are sort of looking at today. We'll see if he has any insight on all of this. Any insight that I'm so far failing to find in this Republican exercise in seeming futility. It seems futile, but hey, you know what? It keeps them from doing legislative damage. So there is that, at least. So as we go to air today, the House has just finished round six of trying to elect a House Speaker, with ballots 4, 5, and 6 coming today so far, after the first, second, and third ballots had similar results on Tuesday, each time with the Democrats' nominee, Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, receiving the vote of every single Democrat, every single unified Democrat, something that has not happened for a Democratic leader since Nancy Pelosi first became Speaker back in 2007. There seems to be no sign of Democrats breaking apart in any way. Every time that there has been a ballot, now 6 times as we go to air, Hakeem Jeffries has received exactly 212 votes from all of the Democrats, while the Republicans have split their votes between McCarthy, who received 201 votes on ballots 4, 5, and 6 so far today, which is actually down by one vote from what he received on the third ballot on Tuesday. So things are not moving in the right direction for Kevin McCarthy, but everyone, you know, is pretty much holding firm to their intransigence on the GOP side, and they are getting nowhere quickly. In a few slight variations on the dysfunctional theme on Wednesday, while New York's Hakeem Jeffries has been nominated each time by California's Pete Aguilar on the Democratic side on each ballot. I think, by the way, I think he's now the Democratic whip, the new Democratic whip, if I'm not mistaken, Aguilar. Aguilar nominates Hakeem Jeffries every time, but the efforts of McCarthy supporters and of the rebel 20 or so, even farther right wingers, those nominations have had a little bit of a nuance. Each time McCarthy is nominated, it is by someone else, as if that will make some sort of a difference. On Wednesday's ballots 4, 5, and 6, McCarthy's name was placed into nomination by Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin, and then Warren Davidson of Ohio, who you heard at the top of the show, and then Kat Kamick of Florida, respectively, in those three ballots. I've never heard of, I heard of Mike Gallagher, but other than that, Davidson, Kamick, no idea who these people are. Don't know if it, well, apparently we do know if it'll make a difference to the vote, because they nominated them, and the exact same thing happened on all three ballots. The GOP obstructionists, however, had an interesting play on Wednesday, after Byron Donalds of Florida on Tuesday the first day of this madness, after he initially had voted for McCarthy on the first two ballots, he flipped his support to the rebels on the third vote on Tuesday. So on Wednesday, he was rewarded by being made their nominee, the rebels' nominee, on ballots 4, 5, and 6, each time receiving no more and no less than exactly 20 votes. Now, who is Byron Donalds? Because no, I had never heard of him either before Tuesday. So he's an African-American Republican, a second-term member, or he will be if he's ever allowed to be sworn into this new Congress. He was nominated the first time on Wednesday to be speaker on ballot number 4 by Chip Roy of Texas in what seems to be a fairly transparent move to try and, you know, be able to claim that, you know, these Republicans nominated a black man for the job.
Yeah, it does appear to be like that.
So, you know, Democrats will have to help them now, right? Wrong. That said, in 2000, this guy, Byron Donalds, actually pleaded guilty to a felony bribery charge as part of a scheme to defraud a bank, which, by the way, seems pretty on brand these days for Republicans, I guess. Let's select the guy who has already been convicted of a financial felony to be our leader in the U.S. House.
Just to sort of get ahead of the game.
Right. So that's who he is. In round 5, then, of the voting, he was nominated the second time on Wednesday by Congresswoman Lauren Boebert of Colorado. You've heard of her. She won her own election just barely by over 500 votes in November. And she talked about the need to listen and to work with others more closely after she lost by such a slim margin. But of course, that was days ago. She can't be expected to remember everything, you know, days later. Rebellions can take a lot out of a gal. I don't have to tell you that, Desiree. And then finally, after failing to select a speaker, after 5 rounds of voting, they did the same exact thing again. They nominated the same exact people again in round 6, this time with Byron Donalds being nominated by Pennsylvania Congressman Scott Perry, who may well be indicted himself for his own part in supporting the January 6, 2021 insurrection and attempting to steal the 2020 presidential election. During Scott Perry's nomination speech for Byron Donalds, he ironically complained that crime is running rampant in the U.S., even as he himself may be charged with felonies and as he nominated a man who has already pleaded guilty to felony bribery to defraud a bank. So none of that helped in the 6th round of voting that just completed just before we go to air today. The Democrat Jeffries was once again the top vote getter with 212 votes. McCarthy mustered 201 votes in each round so far on Wednesday, and Donalds received just 20 votes each of the 3 times. There was one other change on Wednesday from Tuesday, and that is that Republican Victoria Sparks of Indiana, she has begun to vote present in each round of voting. For now, that has no effect, but since a majority of those present and voting is required to determine the speaker, that number is currently still 218 needed for a majority. But that number could go lower if other members vote like Sparks simply present, or they abstain altogether in the days ahead. As we go to air, the House has now voted to adjourn until 8 p.m. Eastern Time Wednesday night, after which they will show up and vote some more, or something else will happen. And nobody at this hour knows exactly what it is. They could adjourn. They could come up with, well, who knows what they'll come up with. Whatever it is, if it is of any note at all, or probably even if it isn't, we will discuss it on our next broadcast. But for now, this means that we can go to a break as well. We'll come back with data researcher Tom Bonier, one of the very few folks who appears to have gotten the 2020 elections right when the professional forecasters were all falsely predicting a red wave, a red tsunami that would wipe out Democrats. That didn't happen. But following a 4,000-word analysis by the New York Times over the weekend headlined "The Red Wave Washout, How Skewed Polls Fed a False Election Narrative," an article which cites Bonnier extensively as one of the few who got it right, well, we now have a better idea of what actually happened, what went wrong, and how the GOP apparently, yes, even figured out how to game the polling forecasts at sites like Real Clear Politics and 538.com. That's all straight ahead, along with Tom's insights into the ongoing House GOP madness. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast.
Five major corporations now control more than 80% of the media in the United States, but they don't control us. The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. You can make a difference. Support independent media. Drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Tread carefully. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. On New Year's Eve, the New York Times published a deep dive analysis of sorts of lessons learned from the 2022 midterm election results. It is headlined, quote, "The Red Wave Washout, How Skewed Polls Fed a False Election Narrative." Those polls may have fed a false election narrative to the New York Times and pretty much all of the other mainstream corporate media outlets, even as, well, some of us weren't really biting, including a number of independent data analysts who weren't buying it either. One of whom joins us here momentarily to discuss both the Times analysis and the madness underway in the U.S. House once again today, as you may have noticed. But just to give you an idea of the thesis behind the Times' otherwise excellent, if months overdue, 4,000-word analysis of what actually went sideways in last year's critical midterm elections, let me share the story's lead example. The Times' Jim Rutenberg, Ken Bensinger, and Steve Eder report, Washington State's Democratic U.S. Senator Patty Murray had consistently won re-election by healthy margins in her 3 decades representing her home state. 2022 seemed no different. By midsummer, polls showed her cruising to victory over Republican newcomer Tiffany Smiley by as much as 20 percentage points. So when a survey in late September by the Republican-leaning Trafalgar Group showed Ms. Murray clinging to a lead of just 2 points, well, at first it seemed like an aberration, an outlier poll. But in October, 2 more Republican-leaning polls put Murray barely ahead, and a third said that the race was a dead heat. For Patty Murray, who has served in the Senate since 1993, she won her previous re-election in 2016 by 18 points. As the red and blue trend lines of the closely watched Real Clear Politics average for the contest drew closer and closer together, with each new Republican poll released, news organizations reported that Murray was suddenly in a fight for her political survival. Warning lights flashed in Democratic war rooms. If Ms. Murray was in trouble, the thinking in September, October, and November went, well, no Democrat was safe in 2022. Murray's own polling, on the other hand, showed her with a comfortable lead, and a nonprofit regional news site using an established local pollster had her up by 13 points. Still, given all of the uncertainty and apparent mistakes of polling over recent election cycles, Murray's campaign went on the defensive. They scuttled her usual practice of lavishing some of her war chest. She had amassed some $20 million by September of last year. lavishing that on more vulnerable Democratic candidates elsewhere. She didn't do that. Instead, she reaped financial help from the party's National Senate Committee and supportive super PACs, resources that would, as a result, just like her campaign's own funds this year, be unavailable to other Democrats around the country in arguably much tougher battles to win their U.S. Senate seats. A similar sequence of events played out in battlegrounds nationwide. Surveys showing strength for Republicans, often from the very same partisan pollsters, set Democratic klaxons blaring in Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, Colorado, according to the Times. Coupled with the political factors already favoring Republicans, including inflation and President Biden's unpopularity, the skewed polls helped feed what quickly became an inescapable political narrative. A Republican wave election was about to hit the country with hurricane force. At least it was an inescapable political narrative to some. Some who had come to rely largely only upon the polling averages and their related forecasts, updated with each new poll, partisan or otherwise, at places like Real Clear Politics and Nate Silver's infamous 538.com. Indeed, Washington State's Patty Murray ended up clobbering her GOP opponent in November, said to have been so close in these late partisan polls, clobbered her by nearly 15 points. The misleading polls of 2022 did not just needlessly spook some worried candidates into spending more money than they may have needed to on their own races. They also led some candidates in both parties who had a fighting chance of winning to lose out on money that could have made it possible for them to do so, as those controlling the purse strings actually believed polls that inaccurately indicated they had no chance at all. Some of those arguably negatively affected by all of this included Democrat Mandela Barnes, who ended up losing to the unpopular Republican incumbent Senator Ron Johnson up in Wisconsin by just one single point. Then there were Democrats like Tim Ryan in Ohio, Sherry Beasley in North Carolina. In the election's immediate aftermath, the Times reports, the polling failures appeared to be in keeping with misfires in previous years in 2016 and 2020. But a New York Times review of the forces driving the narrative of a coming red wave, one that never came, and of that narrative's impact found new factors at play this year. Traditional nonpartisan pollsters, after years of trial and error and tweaking their methodologies, produced polls that, well, largely ended up reflecting reality, but they also conducted fewer polls than they have in the past. That paucity allowed their accurate findings to be overwhelmed by an onrush of partisan polls in key states that more readily suited the needs of the sprawling and voracious political content machine. While right-wing media outlets gave over-the-top play to the so-called coming red wave, for example, Steve Bannon's War Room podcast predicted a GOP pickup in the House of anywhere from 50 to 100 seats. They actually flipped just 9 seats. That misinformation spilled over into the coverage by mainstream news organizations as well, yes, including the New York Times, who ended up amplifying the alarms being sounded about potential Democratic doom. The virtual bazaar of polls, as a top Republican strategist called it, was largely kept humming by right-leaning pollsters using opaque methodology, in some cases relying on financial support from hyper-partisan groups. Other pollsters lacked experience at all, like two high school juniors in Pennsylvania who started Patriot polling, and they quickly found their own surveys, a 16 and 17-year-old kid, included on the statistical analysis website 538, as did another high school concern based at another high school in Andover, Massachusetts. Shaping perceptions across the ideological spectrum, the steady flow of data predicting a red wave prompted a real-world decision-making process that members of both parties now say could have tilted the balance of the power in Congress. Could have? Well, given the panicked response to those polls, I would say it absolutely did have an effect, though whether it ultimately helped or hurt Democrats around the nation, that's not quite as clear. At the same time, the Times goes on to note in their 4,000-word analysis that not everyone was in fact moved, much less panicked, by those late apparent changes in the polling. Folks like Simon Rosenberg of the New Democrat Network made the case on Twitter and whichever media outlets would welcome him that the polling was, in fact, misleadingly skewed. Tom Bonier of Democratic data clearinghouse TargetSmart, as the Times also points out, worried about the damage being done by overly Republican-leaning polls, particularly as the data that he was following and joining us on this program at the time to discuss during the run-up to the election, well, his data was not based on polling, but on other hard and arguably more reliable data. That data seemed to counter the narrative of a so-called coming red tsunami election and, in fact, buttressed the notion that Democrats were likely to perform surprisingly well in a midterm election that would usually, you know, go to the out-of-power party, in this case the Republicans, by huge numbers. But he and Rosenberg were a decided minority as Democrats freaked out, changed their campaign strategies in the final months, and while actually picking up one seat in the U.S. Senate, ultimately they went ahead and lost their majority in the U.S. House, if only by the narrowest of margins. So what actually went sideways in all of this in 2022? What can we learn from it? And why did folks like Tom Bonier and Simon Rosenberg, and yes, even this program, try to warn folks to ignore those doom and gloom warnings of a coming red wave election that barely, if ever, trickled ashore? Joining us again today is the great Tom Bonier, CEO of TargetSmart and a lecturer at Howard University. Oh, welcome back, Mr. Bonier, and Happy New Year, sir.
Happy New Year to you. It's great to be back.
So, as you can tell, I got plenty to ask you about regarding this Times story, as I had initially planned. Very interesting. But first, Tom, given the ongoing madness this week in the House and the Republicans' complete inability, it seems, to even select a speaker so they can begin the 118th Congress, I kind of need to tap your wisdom on that for a moment. Republicans continue to hold ballot after ballot, wherein their favorite candidate, Kevin McCarthy, cannot get to 218 votes to win the speakership. So first, what's your top line response to all of this? Why is this happening, and what does it mean for both Republicans and Democrats here?
Yeah, you know, I guess all I can say is it's not very surprising. I don't think it's surprising to you either. I think in the end, McCarthy is reaping what he has sown. And look, this is the problem with the Republican Party now. And you can use your favorite analogy, you know, the genie out of the bottle, the toothpaste back in the tube.
Yeah.
it's not surprising. Mm. They've empowered this caucus. They've grown this caucus. They've made space for this caucus, and now this caucus is defying him and preventing him from the one thing that he's wanted apparently more than anything else. And it's hard to feel sorry for him.
Well, yeah, it is. I don't feel sorry for him at all. They've done this to themselves, but I'm still trying to figure out, Tom, you know, what do you have any sense what it is that the so-called, you know, never Kevins here who seem to be growing in size, what it is that they actually want? I mean, what it is that McCarthy is unwilling to do for them? Or is this, I'm sort of coming to see it, that it's more simply about claiming a scalp, any scalp, yeah, so they can, you know, claim that they did something tangible, they smashed something or someone, and somehow claim victory. That seems like the only thing left.
Yeah, my best estimate is they want attention, which is what they've always wanted. And you're right. I think they want to be able to show some amount of power, and then to be able to leverage that in future legislative battles. And the problems that McCarthy is having today and this week and moving forward are going to be the same problems that McCarthy or whomever will emerge from this as speaker, probably not McCarthy, it seems, will have for the next 2 years. That's the thing. This isn't a one-off. I don't think that this caucus is going to suddenly behave. They've had a nihilist streak from the beginning, and now they're empowered. And so they will be doing what they can to shut down government when it comes to spending bills. You know, this is just a preview, I'm afraid.
It's like the one thing they're good at is shutting things down. And I got to say, you're right. I was not surprised by any of this, at least the initial vote against McCarthy. You could see that coming for weeks. I got to say, though, I was actually kind of surprised, at least on day one and again in the days following, the number of people voting against him and the fact that they're holding together over these rounds of they're even increasing. I may have underestimated how pathetic these people actually are.
Well, I do think it's about power. I think that if they were to back off, then they would be seen as a group who want to make a big show, get a little attention, but then eventually they'll fall in line, and then I think that would disempower them in the future over the next 2 years. So I believe it, you know, they've seen it as important to them to hold their line here. And to your point, they need to create a consequence. They need to be the ones who put someone else in there. And in the end, I don't think they'll care that much because, you know, who are they going to get as one of their own in the caucus? I'm not sure who they see as one of their own and someone who they would actually view as is viable. So I imagine it will be one of these second run candidates.
Yeah,
he seems to be the most favorite, you know, although they have not put him to a vote yet, which tells me that they are sort of holding back as a potential compromise at that point.
Scalise, it really does seem at this point anyone but Kevin, just so they can, you know, claim a scalp. You're right about power and dominance, and if they back down now, well, then they'd be showing weakness. All right, well, I was going to say much more interesting, but these are both kind of interesting, but the New York Times analysis of this so-called red wave washout last year after polls were skewed, as they report, by this late wave of hard right and false partisan polling that affected the polling averages. It freaked out Democrats. It resulted in money being moved around, being spent where it wasn't needed or not being spent in places where it was, in places that it could have had, you know, it could have resulted in a larger majority for Democrats in the U.S. Senate, maybe even retaining the House. Is this a matter of Republicans, Tom Bonner, figuring out how to game the now infamous polling averages at places like 538 and Real Clear Politics? They seems like they figured out how to game pretty much everything else in the political system. Is that what happened here in 2022?
Yeah, simply yes, that is what happened. And it couldn't have happened without others playing along with it and empowering it. But yeah, that's what happened. A big part of this opportunity, and you mentioned this a moment ago, was the void that was created by the high-quality pollsters, generally partnerships between academia and media, if not just explicitly mainstream media surveys. Mm-hmm. But in prior election cycles, we've always had far more of those polls. So there wasn't as much oxygen for these right-wing red wave pollsters to actually make a mark. But what we had was both sides of the equation were changing dramatically. As you noted, those mainstream high-quality polls were slashed, far fewer of them. And at the same time, these right-wing pollsters increased exponentially. And so, sure, they saw the opportunity there and they jumped in. And, you know, you mentioned, and the New York Times mentioned, some of the bigger ones, the Trafalgars of the world, Inside Advantage. But there were, you know, maybe a dozen or more in the end, others that weren't as prolific. But, you know, the one thing they had in common from my perspective was they were pollsters I'd never heard of before. And they all coalesced. And, you know, they were all producing very similar numbers in the same states, and they were successful. In the end, they were successful. You know, and were they successful to the point where they were able to create a red wave? No. But they were successful to the point where Republicans won some races that I don't think they would have without this happening.
Mm. Why you mentioned that the Times mentioned there was a lack of polls from the major nonpartisan pollsters. Why was that? Why did they pull back this year? Do you have any understanding of that?
Yeah, I think it's two things, two factors. One was cost. Polling has just become more expensive as response rates have diminished significantly. It wasn't that long ago that these gold standard pollsters could get 20% response rates, meaning call 100 people, get 20 people to take the survey. Mm-hmm. We're at a point now where you're lucky if you're getting 1.25%.
Mm.
You know, one or two people out of 100. And so it gets much more expensive to call number after number after number to get the responses you need to get a sample. So the expense, and then accuracy concerns. I think a lot of media outlets felt burned after issues from 2016 and 2020, and they felt like it was in some way potentially damaging their brand. And so you saw some of these media outlets just pull out and say, there are problems with polling. Mm. We don't have confidence in these numbers, so we're going to take a step back. And those two factors combined to just create this great void, unfortunately.
And when I asked you if this was, you know, done purposely to game the, you know, the forecasting averages, do we actually have evidence? Do we know? I mean, like I mentioned, there was, you know, those two high school kids in Pennsylvania. Were they actually part of this scheme to put out these kind of polls? Did they know they were? Do we have evidence of that yet, that they knew that they were participating in this sort of conspiracy, if you will, to game the polls? And, you know, Real Clear Politics is kind of a right-leaning outfit. I'm not surprised at that. But did, you know, folks like 538, Nate Silver, not see this coming, not look at this and go, wait a minute, these are pollsters we've never heard of before. They're all coming in as partisan pollsters. Their numbers are, you know, outliers from the nonpartisan polls. Something is wrong here. I mean, where were the gatekeepers to prevent this from happening in that sense?
Yeah, I think that's the biggest issue. But to your first question, we don't know. You know, there's not a smoking gun here. All we can do is observe the patterns, observe this relative to prior elections, and just note that it was entirely unprecedented, this flood, this coordination. It points towards some level of intent, but I can't ascribe intent to certainly not to everyone in there. And you mentioned the high school students, and maybe this is just me trying to be softer on them because they are kids. I think it's great that high school kids were doing polls. Genuinely think I don't mean to be dismissive of that. I think it's a cool project. Uh-huh. I think the problem was when platforms like 538, to your point, the gatekeepers, who are trusted sources, to take all of this information. There's nothing stopping a Republican firm from putting out a poll in a race. And in fact, that's generally what happens. We all know this. On campaigns, often when a campaign is facing a difficult environment, they're running behind in a race and they can't make up that gap, or maybe bad news comes out, they'll release a biased poll that will suggest that conventional wisdom is wrong and they're actually winning, in the hope that that will raise them more money and create a sense of momentum and turn things around. And so those polls have always been out there, not as many as we've seen this time around. But 538, aggregators like them, it's their job to sort through that and provide a clear sense of what all of this means. And they failed. They entirely failed. And so those high school students, you know, they should have, 538 should have been in a position to look at that and say, well, this is problematic and we're not going to include this. But a popular refrain that we've heard over the last handful of election cycles, when a poll would come out and people looked at it and said, looks like an outlier, they'd say, just throw it into the average. Trust the average is something you hear all the time.
Yeah.
And the idea is, well, okay, poll by poll, you may have outliers, you may have polls that are not going to be quite accurate, but just the brute strength of numbers, that if you have a lot of polls together, those outliers will become muted. And generally, that's worked in the past. Mm-hmm. But the problem was this cycle was different in that there was such a partisan bias in where these polls were coming from that you couldn't trust the average. And the fact is, we knew that. And that was the alarm that we were sounding on this very program and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, frankly, the response was generally dismissive at best and often mocking, including from Nate Silver.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and what he called, he accused you and Stuart of smoking hopium or something like that. I think that was his famous.
Smoking hopium.
Yeah, because you guys were pointing out, no, the data that is not poll-related seems to show us something entirely different. And your hopium sounds like it was actually pretty good hopium. Maybe I can get a bag of that myself. But it wasn't just Nate Silver. It was media outlets. What were the corporate media outlets saying to you when you were pointing out your, and they weren't predictions per se, but you were saying, hey, our data, not based on polls, is showing us something entirely different based on, you know, turnout data, new registration data, special election data, and so forth. What was the response from the corporate media on that?
You know, it's interesting because I did experience actually a pretty wide range of responses. I mean, the most common response was not, you know, mocking, but but certainly, you know, the notion that they would have to take what I say with a grain of salt, and that it's clearly partisan and that it wasn't in line with what they were hearing. So there was an amount of skepticism, and certainly what you saw in the reporting from mainstream media was tainted and sort of directed in the notion that there was going to be a red wave. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a period of time in September where people were open to the notion that maybe the red wave wasn't happening, and then there was that one New York Times poll that came out that looked bad for Democrats, and that sort of closed the door. I will say, and I want to give credit, when we started reporting on, and this is when you and I first spoke last summer, when we started putting out analysis based on the Dobbs effect and showing women registering to vote at a much higher rate after the Dobbs decision. And
the what Supreme we Court Kansas, decision under overturning Roe v. Wade, yeah.
That's right. And so what we saw in Kansas with just a surge in young women voting and producing the surprise 18-point victory for the pro-choice no vote there, and then the Democratic victory in the special election in New York and then in Alaska. And at that point, I will say, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that 90% of the reporters who were reaching out to me were women. And
really?
Those reporters I spoke with overwhelmingly were not approaching this with that air of skepticism.
Interesting.
You know, I think we can read into that what we will, but I it's not surprising to me that women saw what happened with Dobbs and saw this reaction and understood it.
Yeah.
And, you know, every reporter is going to approach anything with skepticism in the partisan realm. But, you know, there was certainly that connection, and they were the ones who were writing about this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it wasn't as much so from male reporters.
They were the ones who were writing about what your findings were and Stuart Rosenberg's findings were that sort of countered this developing narrative that there was a red wave coming.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, in the end, you talk about this notion of the sort of mocking, smoking hopium response, which was certainly common at that point, especially in the last couple of weeks of the election. The irony there is that the counterweight to that notion, you know, what we were saying, that we didn't see a red wave forming, was really just the polls. That was it. That's what they had. And it wasn't all the polls, as you said in your intro. It was just some of the polls. It was a majority of the polls, but when you filtered out these red wave Republican pollsters, it showed a close and competitive election. Whereas, as you have noted, the analysis that Simon and I were putting out day after day was focused on the polls to some extent, but a critical view of the polls and pointing out the issues with these polls and the imbalance, but also early vote. And also special election data, and also voter registration data, and contribution data. And the point we were making is you really need to take all of this into account to have a full picture here. and that we can't trust the polls in aggregate. We can't trust 538 and Real Clear Politics because they have been biased willingly by this red wave effort. So it was ironic that what we were doing was much more comprehensive and in some ways complex, yet the analysis was being dismissed
exactly.
as opium, which is odd.
Yeah, you were the ones who were dismissed. Well, let me just throw a counter here, and I got sort of two questions I want to try to fit in very quickly. The Times notes that by late October of last year, the Republican wave had surged into a so-called red tsunami. A phrase uttered nearly 4,000 times that month on radio, TV, podcasts, according to a media tracking firm, a more than tenfold increase from September. References to a red tsunami then nearly doubled again in the first 8 days of November, including from not just GOP outlets, but also from mainstream outlets as well. But, Tom Bonner, can a case be made that these skewed polls, skewed by, you know, this ton of last-minute partisan polls, including from the high school kids, et cetera, that that actually ended up helping Democrats, that it sort of freaked them out a bit and sort of goosed turnout for Democrats in the bargain? Can that case be made?
You know, some people have theorized that. I don't buy it. I don't think it's something that we can necessarily test or prove. But my biggest concern and where I see those polls having an impact, because people have made the argument both ways, right? That if people think a race is not competitive, they're not going to vote. I mean, what I'll say two things on this. I saw just in my own interactions with people, generally on Twitter, with rank and file activists, was when I would share stats that produce some level of hope, talking about voter registration data, that sort of thing, I would get responses, and I received hundreds of these over the last month of the election from people saying some version of, I was so demoralized, I didn't think we had a chance, and then I saw this data, and I signed up for a shift to text or to call voters or to canvass. And that's not to say that I'm some sort of hero, because I'm certainly not, but it's to make the point that my experience with seeing people who were demoralized by this notion of a red wave, the notion that was inevitable, and that they felt like they needed to check out, because we've all been through 6 years of really oppressive news cycles and a sense of hopelessness in many ways. And I think a lot of people felt like they couldn't go through that. And having a sense that there was hope and that these elections were winnable, I think, was important for a lot of people. But I think perhaps more quantifiable, in a sense, is the way these polls shaped media narratives. And the New York Times article touches on this a bit. And I've talked with a lot of reporters, including the reporters in this piece, about this notion, and I haven't had anyone push back on me on this. If we believe that the job of a reporter is to explain what's happening and how and why is it happening, if their belief from 538 Real Clear Politics was that Democrats were losing, then they were going to write stories explaining how and why Democrats were losing. And the example they use in the article that I'd mentioned to them at the time was Wisconsin. You mentioned this in the intro with Mandela Barnes. That was a race where, when you look at what voters in Wisconsin were waking up to every day, the stories that they were reading, it was about crime and inflation. And it was an attempt to describe why Mandela Barnes, who was leading at one point in the polls, was now losing. Now, reality, as you said, he lost by a point, about 25,000 votes. If the polls were accurately reflecting that, I think the stories would have been different. They would have been waking up to stories about why Ron Johnson, the incumbent senator, is in a fight for his life, why he is losing when incumbents otherwise were generally doing quite well. And I think that changes how people vote to some extent. Could that have had 13,000 people switch their votes? Possibly. And I think that's where it had the impact. It's people voting based on what they believe to be true. And all they were told for the last month of this cycle was that crime and inflation were rampant and it was hurting Democrats. Yeah. And I think that, in the end, became a self-fulfilling prophecy to some extent.
And, you know, in one sense, I feel like, hey, credit to the New York Times doing this deep dive for, like I said, 4,000 words, you know, looking at this, looking at where they went wrong. I'm a little bit tired of there being a need for these mea culpas from the mainstream media outlets after almost every election about what we got wrong. And even in this one, they talk about, you know, this led some candidates in both parties who had a fighting chance of winning to lose out on money that could have made it possible for them to do so. And then actually don't think they list any Republicans who that actually happened to. But in trying to learn from this somehow moving forward, what if anything, last question here, what can be learned moving forward? What should we keep in mind over the next 2 years as we get towards 2024? And with all of these mistakes that seem to keep happening year after year in both the polling and the media's coverage of it, I kind of, you know, feel like, have we reached the end of polling's usefulness altogether at this point, Tom?
We'll never be able to quit polling.
Really?
Despite how
really?
Much people talk about that, you know, people are too addicted to it. The reality is, you know, the real utility of polling, what we see and what we in the public interact with is the tip of the iceberg. It's the horse race. But in reality, the campaign utilization of testing messaging, of looking at which voters are moving based on different messages, mm-hmm. it still works quite well. We just have to accept that. There's a wider aperture here in terms of our notion of who's winning or losing a race, and we just have to be okay with that. Mm-hmm. And we have to then let in these other data sources that I was mentioning mm-hmm. to give us a better yeah. sense of who's going to vote and what these elections look like. I think in terms of lessons and takeaways, you know, a broad sense, and I want to be clear, I think, yes, the press deserves some of the blame here, but in the end, one of the bigger problems was there was this red wave effort from polls. There was the media reporting on it, but Democrats were generally complicit in this in a way, too, because yes. these reporters were hearing, and we all saw these stories, and yeah. we saw cable news, where Democratic consultants were going, sometimes on the record, sometimes on background, talking about how badly Democrats were going to lose, and talking about inflation and crime. And the reality was, that was wrong. And as Democrats, we always are harder on ourselves than I think we need to be. I think it's good that we're introspective. I think it's good that we hold ourselves to a higher standard. But we also have to celebrate our victories. And this is hopefully a takeaway from this cycle, is the Republican Party, under Trump's leadership and guidance, is incredibly unpopular. Mm-hmm. And Americans have rejected extremism now in four consecutive general elections, and Democrats need to build on that. We have such a wonderful opportunity, and this was not the best election for us by any means. It was not a perfect election, but it was a good election for Democrats, and we have a path going forward, and I think we need to be, in general, positive, more positive than we've been, and there's a lot of reason to believe that that is something that the American public is reacting to and will react to more if we can continue on that path. And you see what's happening, where we started this conversation with the Republican Party in disarray.
Yeah.
It's such a wonderful opportunity for Democrats to paint a different picture and to be a contrast to that, and to do what, you know, what the president is doing in reaching across the aisle on issues like infrastructure and actually getting things done and celebrating those accomplishments. And so I hope that's what we see. And so, yes, polling will still be there, but we have to. My hope is that over the next 2 years of this cycle, that the media and consultants in general lift up other data sources along with the polling, widen the aperture, and also just accept the fact that we don't need to predict outcomes.
Correct.
We're not going to be able to do it with perfect accuracy. So accept the fact that we're not wizards and we don't have a crystal ball and that surprises might happen.
There you go. And it sounds like your party could just, you know, enjoy some more hopium at this point rather
Absolutely.
Than doom.
Test, pass the hopium around.
Right, rather than doom and gloomium. You can find that hopium over at targetsmart.com. You can find Tom Bonier, the CEO of TargetSmart, a democratic data solutions firm. You can find him on the Twitters still, I believe, at T. Bonier. Are you on the Mastodon or anything yet, Tom?
I'm there, but I
all right.
It just doesn't feel like home quite yet.
No, it doesn't. So you can still find him at, and you should follow him at, T. Bonier. He has a great Twitter feed as long as it lasts. Tom, always great speaking with you, my friend. I look forward to the next opportunity, sir.
Likewise. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Wait, okay, hopium and what is it? You said gloomy.
Doom and gloomium.
Doomium, yeah. And gloomium. Did you just make that up?
Yeah, I think I did, as a matter of fact. Yeah.
Although I do want to say, I'm very glad that Tom is able to look at the all other data that has helped inform and make sure that he is accurate about the public policy sentiment. But I think it means that people should maybe anticipate a similar gaming of the polls as the right-wing House Republicans start sending out their messaging bills claiming the American people want this. But we might have to actually be aware of some poll gaming going on.
Of course. That's what Republicans do. Rather than, come up with ideas that Americans actually like and want to vote for and want to support them because of, they figure out how to game the system. And that, of course, is why they turn around and blame, claim that Democrats are doing it. Democrats are stealing elections. Democrats
always
are doing
projecting
all of these things. Yes, they are. Because that's what they do. They have gamed the entire system from top to bottom.
And it works for them, or it has up to now for the most part.
It does. It does. If you have a House right now that has a Republican majority, as narrow as it is, the fact that they have a majority at all after just 2 years ago supporting an actual uprising of Congress and pretending that a presidential election was stolen, and they're rewarded 2 years later by a majority in the House. Of course, that comes because what do? They gamed the House maps.
Yes.
And they game the polls to make it difficult for voters to vote. That's how they win. They game the system. So, yes, expect all of that, whether it's the polls, whether it's the elections, whether it's the maps, whether it's anything. Anything but actually, proposing ideas that the American people like. That's it. All right, I'm getting out then. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doy, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible by those of you who support our work by hitting one of those donate buttons at Bradblog, or go straight to bradblog.com/donate. My thanks again to our guest today, Tom Bonier of Target Smart. You can drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am The Brad Blog. Oh, and at the Mastodons, The Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Till we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.